Echo location. Echo location.
Echo.
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 Echo. Location.
You're listening to Echo Location on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm your hostess, Elizabeth Lo Judas. Echo Location is a show that explores the sonic world, the natural soundscape around us. And each broadcast of the show, and the show will air seasonally, so there's four broadcasts a year, and each broadcast will feature an exploration of environmental science and environmental art as related to natural acoustics, and also musical composition and natural acoustics. And I'm just learning about these topics, and so I'm just inviting you along on my journey of discovery about the study of natural sound from a scientific and an artistic perspective. So thanks for coming along for the ride, and hopefully it'll be a sonically interesting one. That was a piece of music by a musician called Maria Lena Zita, and her album is Concert for Bats. And it's music made by bats and for bats, recorded in caves in Italy. Maria Lena is an educator in Italy, and she started with recordings of bats made by William Gannon from the University of New Mexico. And she has woven recordings of cave ambiences with didgeridoo, voice, logs, bone whistles, and seed rattles, and even ringing stalactites in this album of music by and for bats. And in the website Earth Ear, Zita is quoted as saying, "The idea is to dedicate sonorous compositions to the acoustic world of bats, originated from a sort of admiration for these fascinating and very refined creatures that express themselves in frequencies beyond our ability to hear." So echolocation are sound waves emitted from a source and then bouncing off of objects, and the usually animal listens for the sound it made to locate itself in space. And in the case of bats, they can locate prey using echolocation. So there are a number of animals that echolocate, and we're going to listen to their sounds, their echolocation sounds. We will hear a bottlenose dolphin. Little brown bat. Killer whale. Bird. So echolocation is a sonic tool used by animals and also by humans in the use of sonar. But the word echolocation also for me just is about being at home in the world, knowing where you stand sonically as well as visually. Today's echolocator profile is of the oil bird, which is a species of bird that actually echolocates. And they earn the name oil bird because people used to use the nestling baby birds as a source of oil. They used to take the oil from juvenile birds to use in their lamps for light at night. So they earn the name oil bird. Oil birds are South American birds, and they breed and roost in caves in large colonies. The largest colony that was ever found was like 10,000 birds. And they're fruit eaters, nocturnal fruit eaters. And they actually use echolocation to navigate in the dark to find fruit. And they also use their sense of smell to find fruit, so they navigate by sound and smell. And they live in evergreen forests, and they acquire large expanses of forest to forage for fruit year-round. So they're flying around looking for fruit at night, and during the day they roost in caves. When they're in the caves, they're really gregarious and vocal. But when strangers come in, they make snorting sounds. And we're going to listen to a group of oil birds in a cave. These oil birds, they nest in the caves, and they make their nests out of regurgitated fruit and seeds mixed with their own excrement. And they just keep piling on to their throw up and excrement higher each year, and it gets packed down, and that's what they use as a nest. Oil birds are night flying, fruit eating, cave dwelling birds who are echolocators. Well, as far as I know, there aren't any concert for oil bird recordings. So we'll listen to another suggestion from Maria Elena Zita's Concert for Bats, and this one's called Cave Calls. Thank you. So in this first hour, we're going to explore the history of sound recording and the concurrent history of recording of natural sound. In the 19th century, there was an interest in understanding the wave-like properties of sound. And the first recording devices were actually instruments designed to study sound waves. And this interest arose after the Titanic sunk, and scientists wanted to be able to locate icebergs, which drove the invention of echolocators or sonar devices that were developed further by the U.S. and Britain during World War I. And sonar is just another form of echolocation. It sends out a pulse of sound towards an object and uses the returning wave to locate it and estimate distance from it. So that was happening in the early to mid part of the 19th century. And then in 1857, Leon Scott produced a phonoautograph, which used a horn to direct sound towards a diaphragm, and a stylus was attached to the diaphragm that scratched out a line on a rotating cylinder. And this early attempt to interpret and record sound waves was taken up by Alexander Graham Bell and others, who in the 1870s used real human ears to experiment with phonoautographs. So they attached a stylus to the eardrum to make a sound recording. And there's actually this amazing website called firstsounds.org, and they have posted a sound of early sound recording on a phonoautograph using a human ear to make the recording. So it's very brief, but let's listen. So that's pretty interesting to hear through a corpse's vibrations of their eardrum, I guess. But that's how they were doing it back in the 1800s. And by 1877, Thomas Edison had the first functional phonograph, and he did the first recording of a human voice reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb, that child's poem. This is a recording from the U.S. National Park Service of Edison recreating his 1877 recording in 1927.
The first words I spoke in the original phonograph, a little piece of practical poetry. Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
By 1906, there was the first Victrola that was available for home use. And in the 1920s, sound recording was gaining popularity. And the field of bioacoustics, which is a cross-disciplinary science that combines biology and acoustics, was first established. And it was established through the study of insects' response to recorded sound. And one of the main interests was in animal behaviors as observed through sounds. And scientists also became interested in the anatomy and neurophysiology of organs involved in sound production and in sound detection. So in the 1920s, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology became a pioneer in the field of natural sound recordings. In 1929, they had the first recordings of wild birds in an Ithaca City park. And in the 1930s, they made two major cross-country expeditions to record sounds and behaviors of bird species across the U.S., even though the recording system had to be hauled in a panel truck, and when they ran out of road, actually hauled on a mule wagon. But they made all sorts of sound recordings, and by the 1940s had produced the first commercial American bird songs phonograph. The phonograph was bulky and difficult to transport, so even though the field of bioacoustics was underway in the 20s, it really didn't take off until after World War II, when portable magnetic tape recorders became available. And the magnetic tape was developed during really the World War II time period, but in the 50s, it came to the U.S. as portable tape recorders
were available, and more people started making natural sound recordings as well as all sorts of other recordings. And in 1957, the Cornell Library of Natural Sound was established at the Lab of Ornithology, and it's now one of many natural sound libraries. Natural sound collection became happening in earnest in the 1960s. So the portability of recording equipment and technological advances facilitated a huge growth in natural sound recording and scientific study of bioacoustics. And in the 60s, bioacoustics was really an emerging field. And by the late 1960s, a pair of researchers, husband and wife team, Roger and Catherine Payne, collaborated with a professor from Columbia University, Frank Waddington, to use a hydrophone to record humpback whale songs. And this began a study, extensive study of whale vocalization by the Paynes and many researchers after them. And it also ushered in a time of this crossover of natural sound recording from scientific study to the culture at large, because the Paynes were really transfixed by humpback whale songs, and the humpback were on the decline, and so they released a record of whale songs in 1970 that had a really huge effect on the cultural perception of these animals. And also in 1970, singer Judy Collins released an album called Whales and Nightingales, in which she sings with humpback whale songs recorded with a hydrophone. And it inspired other musical explorations of whale songs, including a song by Pete Seeger called The Song of the World's Last Whale.
Adieu, Mormont Hill, and the dear land of Crimant, I bid you farewell. I'm bound off for Greenland and ready to sail, in hopes to find riches, in hunting. The cold coast of Greenland, my love, will not chill. And the longer my absence, more loving she'll feel. Our ship is well rigged and she's ready to sail. The crew, they are to follow the whale, where the icebergs do float and the stormy winds blow, where the land and the ocean is covered with snow. A cold coast of Greenland is barren and bare. No seed time nor harvest is ever known there. And the birds here sing sweetly in But there's no bird in Greenland to sing to the whale. There is no habitation for a man to live there, and the king of that country is the fierce Greenland bear. And there'll be no temptation to tarry long there. With our ship bumper full, we will homeward repair.
I heard the song of the world's last whale as I rocked in the moonlight and reefed the sail. It'll happen to you also without fail if it happens to me, sang the world's last whale. It was down off Bermuda early last spring, near an underwater mountain where the humpbacks sing. I lowered the microphone about a quarter mile down, switched on the recorder, and let the tape spin round. I didn't just hear grunting, I didn't just hear squeaks, I didn't just hear bellows, I didn't just hear shrieks. It was the musical singing and the passionate wail that came from the heart of the world's last whale. Down in the Antarctic, there the harpoons wait, but it's up on land you decide my fate. In London town there'll be telling the tale if it's life or death for the world's last whale. So here's a little test to see how you feel. Here's a little test for this age of the automobile. If we can save our singers up in the sea, perhaps there's a chance to save you and me. I heard the song of the world's last whale as I rocked in the moonlight and reefed the sail. It'll happen to you also without fail. If it happens to me, sang the world's last whale.
So we start to see in the 60s and 70s this interest from the sound art world and from the world of music in natural sound recording. At the same time, the field of bioacoustics and the study of natural sound is growing and developing. Christopher Clark, who is still a leading researcher in ocean acoustics, began working with Roger and Catherine Payne to improve recordings of whales and to learn more about impacts in oceans. And over the past 30 or 40 years, bioacoustic research has really evolved an increasing concern about the impacts that human noise, anthropogenic noise, is having on natural sound systems, especially in the ocean, where sound travels further than in air, and noise from ship motors and propellers and oil exploration and military action is causing a tremendous amount and devastating amount in some instances of noise pollution that is interrupting the ability of whales and other animals, even down to snapping shrimp and fish, to be able to communicate with each other. Those were sounds of anthropogenic noise in the ocean that were recorded and are housed in the Ocean Conservation Research Sound Library. We heard the sound of shipping noise, low-frequency sonar, and seafloor fossil fuel processing. And the Ocean Conservation Research Organization is certainly not the only organization with a sound library these days. Sound libraries and availability of soundscape and species recordings has grown substantially. By the year 2000, the Lab of Ornithology LNS catalog had grown to over 140,000 sounds, and they digitized the sound library and made it available online. There are also other libraries, including the British Library, that has 60,000 selected recordings of music, spoken word, and human and natural environments. The BBC Nature Sound Effects Library, the Discovery of Sound in the Sea Library, and the Aquatic Bioacoustics Lab, which has fish sounds. And fish have an amazingly interesting array of sounds that they make. So we'll listen quickly to two fish, the midshipman, whose sound I love. And the oyster toadfish. So today, as we've heard, natural sound recordings are used as educational tools at nature centers. They're on relaxation soundtracks and a variety of musical styles. And they are also cataloging the calls of lost species and bearing witness to endangered soundscapes. Bernie Krause is a musician turned bioacoustician who has recorded species and natural soundscapes for 45 years. And he was a pioneer in holistic recordings of soundscapes rather than just isolated species recordings. In a recent TED Talk, Krauss said, I'm going to quote him here, "When I first started recording over 4 decades ago, I could record for 10 hours and capture 1 hour of usable material good enough for an album or a soundtrack or a museum installation. Now, because of global warming, resource extraction, and human noise, among many other factors, it can take up to 1,000 hours or more to capture the same thing. A full 50% of my archive comes from habitats so radically altered that they're either altogether silent or can no longer be heard in any of their original form." And we're going to listen to a few recordings from Bernie Krauss in his album, The Great Animal Orchestra, Symphony for Orchestra and Wild Soundscapes, which was recorded with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales in 2014. We're going to listen to a few tracks from that recording.
It is 16,000 years ago, and the plains teem with life. With the presence of the giant armadillo, American cheetahs, saber-toothed tigers, giant beavers, mastodons, camels, caribou, dire wolves, and ground sloths that stand as high as 14 feet on their hind legs, wildlife is everywhere. Birds in great numbers fill the air with flight and song, while tree frogs, peepers, insects, and reptiles saturate the sound field with the intricate tapestry of their voices. It is the end of an ice age, and the leading edge of the massive Wisconsin Glacier slowly recedes to the Arctic Circle. With the Earth's warming, the floral world thrives. The first signs of the boreal forest have taken root in the Western Hemisphere. It thrives through the cold winters and the warm summers, and it is jam-packed with non-human life whose individual voices coalesce into an intense and collective symphony. The planet itself abounds with a vigorous resonance that is as complete and expansive as it is delicately balanced. Every place with its vast populations of plants and animals becomes a concert hall. And everywhere, a unique orchestra performs an unmatched symphony, with each species sound fitting into a specific part of the score. It is a highly evolved, naturally wrought masterpiece. Humans, too, are making their sound heard. They borrow some from what they hear all around them to convey emotion. Perhaps through their body movement and vocal responses, these modern humans will convince the other creatures that they are all just an extension of one sonorant family. This is the tuning of the great animal orchestra, a revelation of the acoustic harmony of the wild, the planet's deeply connected expression of natural sounds and rhythm. It is the baseline for what we hear in today's remaining wild places, and it is likely that the origins of every piece of music we enjoy and word we speak come at some point from this collective voice. At one time, there was no other acoustic inspiration.
You're listening to Echolocation on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Elizabeth Lojudis, and we're going to wrap up this first hour of the show by listening to a sound walk that was recorded at my home at Ravensroos Farm in Hanacroy, New York. So I hope you enjoy.